Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I remember when I first got my iPhone, one of the coolest things to try on the iPhone was this app called Shazam. And with Shazam, if there was music playing on the radio, back then people actually listened to the radio when it came out, or anywhere really, like in a store where it comes up a lot, the grocery store near my house plays the best freaking music. If you want to find out what it is, you just ask Shazam, load up the app, it listens for a little bit, and boom, it tells you what the song is. And back then, I think it would even link you over to buy the song. And it was like magic. It showed you the power of the iPhone. Joining me is one of the co-founders of the company, Shazam. And I wanted to have him here to understand how they came up with the idea, how they built it up, and what it was like when it was sold to Apple. And Philip, I understand that you weren't there at the time. And I want to also find out about what he's up to now. His name is Philip Engelbrecht. He is, as I said, the co-founder of Shazam. It was one of the most used apps in the world, and it was sold to Apple. I'm going to find out about that. I also like to find out about his latest company, Tatari. It turned TV advertising into a digital-like experience where you can actually measure, get real-time data, and have the ability to manage your campaign. If you've heard me interview entrepreneurs who bought television ads, I'm always amazed. Why would they do it? How do they even know if it's working? And they always have these random things like, well, what we do is we buy it in a certain market and then we connect back the IPs. And I go, this is a lot of freaking work to buy it. Anyway, his latest company solves that. We're going to find out about those companies thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you're hiring developers, and we should find out about the importance of developers at Shazam. You've got to talk to them. They are top Tal, and the second is a company I didn't even want to sign up for, but boy, I'm so glad that I did because it helped me close sales in a way that no other software ever did. It's called ClickFunnels. I'll talk about those later, but first, Philip, do you remember the day that Apple bought Shazam? That you found out about it even?
Actually, I don't because it was, if you were to Google this and look it up, it was a very drawn out process. Obviously, you know, I kind of learned before it was publicly announced that Apple was going to buy Shazam, but then actually the acquisition was initially denied by the European kind of regulatory instances, and so that lasted for a while, and then actually I don't remember the exact day that it was finally approved. It just felt so long.
Was there a day when you felt like, I did this? I get to actually like take a breath and realize I did something big here that now has a finish.
You know, I mean, obviously an acquisition is sounds like an, you know, and the name is an exit, right? And then there's that finish. To me, you know, an exit is often kind of associated with the financial outcome, and sure, there's some component to that, but I feel like that moment had come way earlier to me.
When was that? What's a moment in time where you felt like I didn't exactly cross the finish line, but it's as close as I'm going
to
get?
It's actually to me, it's kind of when you see Shazam being used in the wild, as I say, somebody who you don't know or never met, and they actually spontaneously use Shazam. Or even when somebody starts to, you know, suggest that you could use Shazam to recognize a song, those moments, those are definite highlights. As I said, there's no financial component to it, but it's definitely kind of a.
That's the thing. That's the time.
And actually, there's a funny story around this. I always kind of promise to myself if I ever see a person using Shazam in the wild, I'm going to buy him or her a bottle of champagne just like that. And this is now, I'd say. 2007, 2008, I was working at Google at the time, and I'm out in LA, and I go out with a client for drinks to a place which then turned into a nightclub. So it's late last night, and all of a sudden there's this giant guy. He walks up to the speaker, takes his phone, holds it up to the speaker, starts recognizing his song. I'm like, oh my God, there's my moment. So I walk up, you know, very kind of like, you know, cautiously, and I tap him on the back. I'm like, hey, you know, what are you doing as an icebreaker? And the guy turns around, and I don't know exactly how he, in what English words he put it, but he says something to the extent of, bugger off, get out. I was like, okay, he's giant, it was a big guy. So I was like, yeah, that's too bad. You know, that was the bottle of champagne. That's a true story.
Wow. Did you get a financial outcome from it? A significant financial outcome from creating this company?
No, I mean, the founders in Shazam, and you can look this up, the company had been heavily invested in. And so obviously with each investment comes dilution. The investment terms weren't necessarily very founder friendly. And so very few people, at least kind of like look at the team, necessarily made a lot of money.
To give people perspective, this was a company that was founded in 2000, long before the iPhone came out. You worked there till 2004. Then you mentioned Google. You worked at YouTube, where you were head of partnerships for sports and entertainment, which must have been a fun job. Long before that, you went to work as an investment banker. And I'm, as a guy who lives in San Francisco, I'm surprised. You went to Berkeley to study investment banking? This is the hippie center of the world, it feels like.
I was actually an investment banker before I went to Berkeley. And I used Berkeley to do a gentle alt-control delete in my career.
Okay.
I graduated from college. I just knew. Don't ask me why. I just knew I wanted to be an investment banker. I like mathematics. I like exact sciences. I like the fast pace. Also, actually, being an investment banker gives you a remarkable sense of responsibility, right? Because you could control $100 million at the age of 22. And so I really, really liked that component. It also didn't take me too long to realize that it was kind of like a dead-end career. I looked at the people around me, and they were old, right? They were then 30, 35, and they were still doing the same. They were sitting there with, you know, five screens in front of them, the speakers, and yelling to brokers and shouting out orders and stuff like that. I was like, oh my God, like, am I going to do this for the rest of my life? And then I'm going to be 40. I'm going to be too old for this game. And this doesn't sound like a lot of fun. So I actually used Berkeley as, I guess, the sexy way of calling it. Now it's kind of pivot my career.
An intention of going where?
Yeah, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'll be really truthful about that. It'd be fun actually maybe to read my application. It says now for Berkeley what I really said I was going to do. But what did happen is I kind of came to San Francisco because of the lifestyle. I really felt that this was a very desirable place to live. As a matter of fact, back in 93 or 94, I had traveled through the U.S. I had passed through San Francisco. And I was so enamored with the city that I made that promise to myself to one day live or work or retire or go to school here. And so when I applied to business school, I actually turned down very nice schools like Kellogg, which is probably, you know, on paper, maybe even better than Berkeley, but I just didn't want to live in Chicago. I came to Berkeley because of the San Francisco Bay Area. But so back to your question, I also got drawn into the whole dot-com boom. Right, I arrived here in May of 98. I mean,
just when it was in full swing. This is the period where it was really hot.
Yeah, I even didn't know that the Silicon Valley was in the Bay Area, to be honest. So I just came here and wow, that's amazing. And I just truly almost like reinvented myself, learned everything about technology that I didn't know. I would take on consulting projects. I would just completely kind of rewrite myself. A fun story around this is that actually CIA would come to, let me take a step back. So part of that plan was also to do an internship in the US, unlike most international students, go back to your home country. And so I really focused on kind of reinventing myself, rewriting that resume. And so the CIA would also come to Berkeley to interview potential recruits. And so I got invited for an interview with the CIA. And I was like, that's remarkable, right? I didn't know that as a foreigner, you could work for the CIA. So anyway, I went to the interview. And very early on, I mentioned, it's like, you know, I'm a Belgian national. And they're like, oh, one moment, steps out, comes back a minute later. It's like, well, you know, you must understand, we made a mistake. And I was like, okay, I get it. No big deal. But really what I'm trying to say here is like, the extent through which I have had reset myself was so good that I wasn't able to fool the CIA.
Wow. Even with the accent, though?
Well, I think in the interview, they probably figured out. Then again, I mean, you could have an accent and be 100% American, as a matter of fact.
That is true, especially here in the Bay Area, which is one of the things that I love about living here. Your parents, you grew up in Belgium. Your parents were highly educated, and they ran a business. What was the business?
My parents just had a kind of like a medium-sized grocery store.
So they worked in there, I'm imagining 6 days a week, probably closed on Sunday.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. You were working in there, I heard, at 7, 8 years old. You learned the importance of work. And there was one summer, actually it wasn't a summer, it was winter, where you were selling Christmas trees for your dad. Do you remember this? I guess you told this too. Talk about that. I guess you said it to a site called waytopassion.com, which is where our researchers found that story.
Yeah. I mean, I think a credit to my parents, they actually gave me opportunities to work and make money. And so that was one of the many of them. It's interesting when you mentioned earlier, you know, you were open 6 days a week, closed on Sunday. Well, sometimes I would actually run the store on Sunday afternoon and get 10% of everything that was sold. And
I made 100% of everything that was sold.
10%, right? 10, because okay. That made a lot of sense because nobody would come on Sunday anyway. So it was great for my parents. It wasn't too busy. They didn't have to pay me necessarily that much money, right? But I learned the value and virtues of work. And so selling Christmas trees was one of them. That was probably one of the earlier ones where, you know, I helped people pick their Christmas trees and then carry it to the car. And maybe the story you read there, which is actually very funny, my dad would pay me a small commission for every tree sold. I forgot how much it was, but maybe like 10 cents a tree. But then, of course, people who came by the Christmas tree, they were so kind of like just dumbfounded, if not enamored with this little boy, you know, doing business, that, you know, the tips that I got were like an order of magnitude bigger, which my dad, of course, never knew about.
Oh, you didn't tell him. I imagine your dad would have been proud.
For a race.
Yeah. You know, my dad paid me an hourly. I wonder if I would have worked harder if he would have given me commission instead. My job was to hand out flyers for his clothing store, help people out of the store. I knew nothing about clothing.
Yeah, but then you see, if you get paid by the flyer, you probably would lose a few flyers as a little boy.
Maybe by the person who comes in because of the flyer. That would have been a better way to structure it.
There you go. Cost per acquisition, yeah.
One of the things that happened when you decided to control delete your life or your career was you decided, I'm going to find a company to start. And you and your co-founder were sitting and trying to come up with different ideas. Do you remember one of the ideas that you didn't pass, that you didn't do, the one that you did pass?
Yeah, one idea actually I still kind of like regret, at least not having like written a patent on it, and kind of came out of a very personal experience. I had a meeting. So I was living in Berkeley at the time. I had a meeting in Palo Alto, which in the Bay Area is not, distance-wise, it's maybe only 30 miles, but on a rainy day, that could take you 2 hours. I kid you not. And so I was, I was a full hour late for that meeting. And so this was like 98 or 99. And what we used back then was MapQuest, right? You would have Yahoo MapQuest, and then you would print out the directions, right? You wouldn't have a smartphone to track your progress. And I was like, wow, well, MapQuest is good, but it doesn't really tell us much kind of about the driving conditions. At the same time, the FCC had issued kind of some kind of regulation to all the cell phone providers that cell phones had to be able to be located within 70 meters for 911 purposes. So essentially you triangulate on the cell towers. I was like, so in that, an approximate location is known. So if all cell phone providers can share that data back to you on an anonymous basis, then you can truly track and calculate the average speed at which a phone is moving along the freeways and the major streets. And so MapQuest is not just map directions anymore. It actually will also give you estimated travel times, right? So it's a whole mathematical procedure. I went so far to even then kind of like think of, wow, so then, you know, the streets are marked in green when there's no traffic, you know, yellow when it's in lots of traffic, and red when it's a standstill like a traffic light. Well, guess what? That's what Google Maps did in 2005. Actually, at the very least, I should have written a patent on that.
You were going to call it eStalker, I heard.
No, that was one of Chris's ideas.
Oh, that was a different idea?
By
the way, I hadn't thought about MapQuest in years. I went over to it just now, and it's kind of scary that their only innovation, as far as I can see here, is on how to stick ads in. And the reason it's scary is because they really were the leaders, and it's a scary reminder for everybody, for me too, as a guy who's doing interviews here, that it's very easy to fall really far behind and miss out on a huge idea because you're not innovating. So their only innovation is how to stick more ads into this. Meanwhile, Google has been innovating, and has just beaten them. And I've got to keep remembering it. We've got to keep moving better and better, or else I'm dead.
Yeah, I think in general, there's kind of like two types of companies. There's kind of the true, like if you look at, especially at startups, there's companies that truly come up with something new. They invent something, right? And then there's companies that they don't invent, but they have maybe more innovative approach to something. So I'll give you one example. Like if I look at Shazam, that was a true invention. nobody really kind of had even the technology to kind of hold up your phone and deal with all the, you know, the distortions that came with the noise across a large database of music and doing so very fast. And so that was true invention. And so, but of course, the challenges it brings about is that you have to then create your own market and educate people on the user experience and stuff like that. There's another set of companies, they don't invent anything, but they kind of look at existing markets and just innovate what's been done there already. And they don't do it twice better, they do it literally 10 to 100 times better. And I think actually Google is one of the best examples of that. Google hasn't, apart from Google, they're the new company on the side, but Google itself, Google.com, has never really invented anything, right? They didn't invent search. They didn't invent AdWords. That was
good. Didn't invent email, right? No, that was go-to, you were saying, with ads.
And by the way, that's a great example. They literally made Gmail 100 times better than Hotmail. Instead of 10 megabytes, you got a gig. And I feel like either way, kind of, staying up to date and always, move the ball forward demonstrates a key ingredient to success, whether you're kind of a true inventor or an innovator. And so if I look at Atari, my current company, it's not that we invented the measurement of TV advertising or the optimization of TV advertising and buying. It's really that we have come up with approaches which are just an order of magnitude better than whatever anybody else is doing in the industry today.
It seems like you, from your experience, have discovered that inventing something brand new is not as effective as improving dramatically on something that already exists.
Well, it's sometimes harder, right? Sometimes you have to build a new market if you come up with something.
Right.
Right. So.
What are examples of companies that have come up with brand new markets that have actually done really well? Amazon's a good example of that. What else?
Oh, people that have a, sorry.
It seems like what you're saying is, Andrew, there are two different ways to innovate. There's one where you innovate from scratch, and then there's another where you innovate on other people's ideas. And it seems like the latter, the innovate on other people's ideas, is what your experience says is the better approach. Atari is innovating on other people's ideas. It's doing better for you. Shazam was coming up with something brand new and defining a market, and that's harder to do and probably less worthwhile, that we shouldn't be looking for these new brand new ideas.
Yeah, I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I really don't think so.
No?
No, I wouldn't say so. It's just, they're just two different types of companies. That's all.
Okay, and you just want to know where you are. The idea for Shazam came from where then?
That was actually Chris's idea. Okay. Most of many ideas that we had, some of them good, some of them not so good. and it was something that resonated well with me, right? Because who doesn't have that personal experience of hearing a song and not knowing what it was? And there was a point in time where we had to make a decision, right? We had to pick one and focus. Focus is super important. Go with it. And that was Shazam. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to come back in a moment. I'm going to first talk about my sponsor. Then I'm going to come back and understand why you even thought there'd be a market, how you thought you were going to make money. This was a period where you had to make money or else, well, I guess maybe there was still leeway to not make money, but I still want to know what your business model was when you started. But first, I've got to tell you and everyone else about a company called ClickFunnels. Philip, I did not want to work with ClickFunnels. Speaking about a company that did not innovate, there are other people who didn't create something from scratch. There are tons of different software that you can use to create a landing page to collect email addresses, to create a follow-up page to sell, to create the whole flow. I knew it. I had it. I bought lots of different software for it. So what do I need ClickFunnels for? And then this guy, Caleb Hodges said, look, you hired me to get you more sales, more leads. Let me just use the software that I like. And at first I said, no, use what we have. And then he said, Andrew, trust me. That's why you hired me. I said, okay, absolutely. That is why I hired you. Let's do it. He created a landing page to explain to people what these chatbots were, which is what we were starting to sell. And it collected more email addresses. And so I said, let's stick with it. Then I think it was Rebecca who said, after somebody gives us their email address, why don't we just put a follow-on sales page? ClickFunnels enables that. Now, Rebecca is not a marketer. She's a person who is just figuring this stuff out. She goes along. She's good at using software. She added a sales page to it. Suddenly, we took one of our funnels, we added a sales page to it, and we're closing sales. And then they have these other little features, Philip, that I don't think you would love, because I don't know that you get into this stuff. People who do love it. Like, imagine this. Somebody buys, they put their credit card in. Underneath the credit card information, but above the button, I think it's called an order bump. You could, with one little addition on their form, on their site, you can add an order bump. So now I've got a checkbox that says, hey, for $5 more, you can get this other thing. People check it. The majority of people check that checkbox, get the extra thing for a few extra bucks for them. Great for me. It adds to the revenue. Now, all that means that we make more money, we get more product for our customers, and we could spend more on advertising, and we could just, frankly, the momentum of growth is exciting. So over on my right, I'm going to show it again. This is what, at some point I said, hey, they've got this thing called a 2-comma club for people who've made over $1 million with a funnel, a single funnel, which is a page that creates email addresses, then moves people along and sells to them. Are we even in this 2-comma club? Let's just go check. So Rebecca checked. She said, yeah, absolutely, Andrew. We've been in the 2-comma club for a long time. I said, fill out their form, get verified. Let's get it. And so we are. Look here. You can see it right here, Philip. This is their 2-comma club gold record. We hit it with one funnel. All for this thing I didn't even want to sign up for because it seems dead simple because other people do it. They made it even easier. Rebecca, I, Marcella, anyone on the team can go and improve our funnel and get more sales done. And that's one of many funnels that we've worked on. If anyone out there, including you, at some point, you're going to have some reason for somebody to come in, maybe get a white paper, maybe eventually sign up for a demo or something. Even if you don't close sales within the funnel, you should know you could close sales within the funnel, or you could just get people to move a little closer to a sale. If you go to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy, they will let you try their software for free, start to get results. And if you love it, you can keep being a customer of theirs. If you don't love it, I would say, yes, you can cancel. But number two, you should let me know why, because I want to understand why it's not working. These freaking guys created great software and I love it. clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. Thanks so much for being a sponsor, ClickFunnels. All right. That company, by the way, is making bank. I interviewed them on stage. I put the people on, like I said, I'm putting you on the spot. Tell me what your revenues are. You told me before we started, Andrew, I'm not telling you my revenue. It's just not the way we do things. I felt a little bad. Maybe I'm a little gauche, but I don't care. They told it. They said, all right, Andrew, we'll tell you whatever you want to know. Okay, let's continue then with the story. Where did you think that you were going to make money with Shazam?
If you were to look at the early business plans, it kind of suggested the pay per use, right? Let's say pay a buck per recognition, of which the company would retain a certain percentage, let's say half. And then, of course, right, you multiply it through with volume and an international rollout. And of course, quickly pointed out that Shazam was going to make billions and billions of dollars.
Wait, you really imagined that to get a song? On the radio, onto whatever, to understand what it was, I would pay money for it?
Yeah, because back in those days, people would pay, $1 or $3 to dial a short number to get traffic updates.
Oh, you can pay for that. So your number was 2580, which I didn't realize until now. It's straight down the center, right? The 2580 are the middle numbers on the dial pad. And so people just have to go down the middle. And if they did that, they were charged by the phone company and you collected money from it.
Yeah, that's right.
Ah, got it. So you don't really think about it. You got your cell phone in your pocket. Easy. Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, it was almost a disguised, like, I can't say 1-800 number because that's toll free, but in the olden days, it used to be like a 1-900 number. Yep. It was a premium service. But it used a short dial, which, is more accessible, more memorable, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. And your co-founder, we won't go too deep into it. Your co-founder, Chris Barton, was here on Mixergy. He talked about how you guys figured out the technology behind it, how you hired Avery Wang and the process you went through to hire him to get the software up and running and working. Let's talk about the launch. You put this thing together. You had the software. How did you get anybody to even start dialing 2580?
We had a little bit of a kind of a launch marketing campaign. If I remember well, it was some modest out of home and mostly radio advertising.
Okay.
That was it. Now, what's really interesting is back then you didn't have social media. You didn't necessarily have all kind of these network effects that you could use, right? Where, one person shares something with the other. And so it was stuff going. When we launched Shazam, it wasn't that it took off like a rocket. Quite the opposite. It felt more like flatline.
You launch it. It flatlines. Did you feel like I'm a failure? What did I even leave this whole? My dad had a solid business. Now I started this business. What is this silliness?
No. I mean, like, when you run your own company, you're gonna have so many lows and highs that. get a little more immunity to those lows.
How? How do you get immunity? I still feel immunity to low. I got to tell you, Philip, if I ask you a bad question, I'm not going to move away from this thinking everything's good. I go, Andrew, what do you do next time to fix it? Why is this? I will spend time thinking about it. How do you get to a place in your life where, especially early on, where people don't like your product, they're not signing up, they're not using it, and you feel strong enough to go on to the next move?
Yeah, you know, I think in many ways, when founders say that my company is my baby, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? It's a remarkably good analogy. You just mentioned you have kids yourself.
I do.
I don't know how old your kids are, but let's say that one of them isn't so good at math. I'm just making this up. It's remarkable, Andrew. In what you're saying in the business world, you would ditch your kids and you get rid of them, right? But no, I know what you're going to do. You're going to do the exact opposite. You're going to spend even more time and invest more time on it till it works. And so for all intents and purposes, your startup companies are your babies. If it doesn't go, you're actually going to do maybe the exact opposite.
You know what? That does make sense. I bought my kid a bike that all the parents here had all the different requirements for a bike for the first bike for kids. The only thing that they all agreed on was no training wheels, and I'm big on that. So I got a bike with all the features that they wanted. Philip, it's so heavy. You know about this, huh? You've got kids also. No training wheels? That's a San Francisco thing?
No training wheels.
Training wheels these days.
Brown and learn to swim.
So I got it. I got a bike that was too heavy. It had no coaster brakes. It had hand brakes. It had this. It had anyway. It was too heavy for the kid to ride. And like you said, I just kept working with him. He would freak out about it because it was too heavy to even lift up and he would fall. And you're right. Okay. So you kept going. What do you remember going back? What you did to make it work? What the next set of ideas were?
There was never a silver bullet for a company like Shazam. I'd say this. I mean, obviously the breakthrough came with the iPhone. And the App Store in particular, right? Because that gave us an incredibly powerful...
That's 3-4 years after you left. iPhone came out 2007, the App Store 2008, if I remember right.
I think the iPhone was 2006, the App Store, of memory, 2007. Okay. Right, but that gave an incredible distribution platform. So there's two things I would say to that. So one, it's not that we were stupid. We knew that there was going to be a day where cellular phones or feature phones back then were going to have some type of an operating system, and we were going to be able to do part of the Shazam experience on the device and making it so much better, right? So that's one. Having said that, two, I don't think any of us reasonably expected that the iPhone was going to be that good, so powerful with color, touchscreen, not to mention the kind of the app marketplace. Sure, there's a little bit of luck around it, what I'm trying to say, but it was also negotiated luck, right? Because when we saw that there's an opportunity to build an app on a phone, right, we kind of, took the bull by the horns because we knew that was also going to be the future. We could also have said, like, well, that sounds silly, right? We're just going to carry on with 2580, right? And that would have been a strategic mistake.
We just knew this thing is coming. We're building it to the day when that happens without clear clarity on when or how. We just had, mm-hmm. Here's one of the things that our producer put together for me about the early days of Shazam. You'd have radio DJ say, I'm going to play you a new song, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. If you want to find out, go dial 2580 on your phone and you'll see it. That sounds like a great promotion.
That's an ad. That's an ad, right? That's a readout ad.
Right. Like it's part of the content, if I understand right. The DJ was playing music he'd play anyway. They just happen to add this to it.
Yeah.
You Slack. Doesn't it drive you crazy that the whole day you get these alerts?
Sorry.
Does it drive you nuts? I shifted our company away from Slack. I couldn't deal with the fact that there were constant alerts. I wanted to stay focused.
I kind of I even didn't notice. I think you noticed. I didn't. So
I guess you kind of like it. My wife uses Slack at her job. It is constantly going off. Why did you... Well, first of all, let's talk about you... Before we talk about why you left, one of the things that you realized was, you know what? There's a B2B component of this. What was the B2B component of Shazam, business to business?
Yeah, when the company wasn't doing so well in those early years, I had by then learned a lot about the music industry. and they knew exactly how the music industry operated, where some of the pain points sat. And so one of those things was actually the realization that artists get paid to the extent that their music is actually played on radio and television. And they get paid based on a small sample of airplay, and then it kind of gets prorated out and divided up amongst, you know, the large pool of composers and music writers. Now, if you work from a sample, that means that the bigger musicians get overpaid and the smaller musicians don't get paid because they're simply not part of the of that sample. And so short of it is, I learned that the ability to monitor all radio and television play, not on a sample but on a consensus basis, and doing so accurately and very fast, had value because it would make for a better distribution of rights or and collection related thereto. So when I realized all of this, I started cutting deals with companies like BMI, Clear Channels. Those were, you know, we wanted some numbers. Those were multi-million dollar contracts. And it's remarkable, right? Because when Shazam, on the one hand, was bleeding cash in the consumer business, it was raking it in on the B2B side.
Because they were paying you to understand when their artists were being played on the radio so they could charge more based on that. And the only reason that you knew it was people were holding their phones up like that big guy at the event, listening, having their phones listen for the music, and that's how you knew it.
Yeah, and it was really more about making sure for them that they did the distribution of the collected money to all correctly, so that they wouldn't get sued by small artists. That was a real problem. And if they could prove that they did it correctly, that was just an overall net improvement. Yeah.
I was researching you. I like to put everything into Google and then limit the search to like old time. I see here that don't worry, I didn't find anything that shocking. you're too old to have had like a wacky Facebook page or something. I see that you had a role of secretary appointed on June 12, 2009, and then resigned August 7, 2002. It feels like you were in the company for a short time and then you resigned soon after. I'm trying to understand why, what happened there. Why did you leave Shazam? Maybe that's a better question. Instead of touting all my research, it's better just go straight.
Yeah, company secretary doesn't really mean anything. Somebody has to be the company secretary.
And they put you on the list as that.
Yeah, usually it's a CFO, right?
And so you were also, you're a director, and then you resigned again August 7, 2002. What happened? It feels like something happened in the middle of your tenure there.
No, this is all normal. So when you start a company and you have multiple co-founders, typically all co-founders will be on a board, and then outside investors come in. They will take a board seat, and typically one of the founders has to step down. So eventually, all founders stepped out of the board.
Okay,
normal. So why did I leave Shazam? So it was, I remember well, late 2004. And actually, it comes back to that very earlier point. I wanted to move back to the Bay Area. It was a lifestyle decision. That was okay living in London, but this is not what I wanted. I'm very outdoors. I love surfing, kiteboarding, but at the same time also skiing. And yeah, I just came to the conclusion that life is short, and decided to move back to San Francisco. No, it was not like an overnight decision. So obviously, I discussed this with the then CEO and the board. And stuff like that. I also didn't, you know, it's not like you put in your 2 weeks notice and there you go. So I made sure that it was a solid transition over 6 months, and then, yeah, packed my bags and, you know, actually took a big risk just, you know, as a Belgian national without any work permit, moved back to SF.
And so did you end up with any equity in Shazam after all that? Or just?
Just traditional founder equity, yeah.
And that held on until the sale?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, good. I was a little concerned based on how you were talking that maybe you ended up with nothing. But
I mean, like, I guess everything is relative. It's not that any founders made money that they would retire and buy a private jet or anything like that. You know,
did you buy anything with it? No, it just goes into a big account. Not even a surfboard?
That would be a good move.
Yeah, or a car or something. All right, I am a little bit curious about what you ended up doing at YouTube for a little bit. Can we talk about that, and then also talk about Tatari?
Yeah, love to. Yeah.
All right, great. I'm curious also about the name Tatari. What does that mean? All right, let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. Philip, we didn't get to talk about how you found one person. Avery, why did Avery Wang have such a big impact on you? This kind of ties into my second sponsor, which is TopTal for hiring developers. What is it about Avery that helped you guys do well?
Avery invented the algorithms. And so he was actually not a hire. He became a fully fledged co-founder.
So one of the things that I've been seeing in my interviews, and I'm going to keep finding it throughout the interviews, is that you find that one person who is phenomenal, it's not like having five other people is going to compensate for them. It's not like if you went to Upwork and found four other people or 10 other people that they would have ended up with the same algorithm, with the same technology that Avery could have done on his own. Am I right?
Yeah, true.
Right? It's a whole other world when you deal with best of the best developers, which is why Google is here, even though they could be anywhere. They know that there are some phenomenal developers here, which is why people go to TopTal. TopTal prides themselves on making it so hard to be in the TopTal network that only the best of the best developers make it in. And so when you, Philip, when you finally need a developer, or I need a developer, anyone who's listening to me needs a developer, all you have to do is go to toptal.com/mixergy, hit a button. Then you'll schedule a call with a matcher. The matcher, Philip, will understand how you work, like you Slack, where do you, like what hours do you guys like to work, what technology do you build on, what are you missing, and then they will find someone who has done the work that you're looking to hire for, who also works in the way that you like them to work. So someone like me couldn't deal with a Slack environment. Someone like you couldn't deal with our Basecamp environment, which is like low conversation. I've hired people who are really phenomenal, but without the conversation, they can't work with me because I'll go for a week or two without talking to them. Right? Everyone, every company has its quirks. Every company has its needs. TopTal's matchers take all that into account. They go out, they find you one or two people who are perfect. And if you like them, talk to them. If you like them, you can hire them. If you don't, you move on. And if you do hire them using my special link, you will get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. All you have to do is go to top is in top of your head, tal is in talent, TOPTAL.com/mixergy. So, what was it like to go and work for YouTube in the entertainment space, in the sports space? I feel like there you must have some stories about people who you recruited to have a partnership with YouTube. You've got tattoos. You're definitely cooler than the average tech person when I interview. I watch you carefully. Accent.
It was a really exciting time, actually. You know what's interesting? I always feel that I kind of predicted the importance of online video very well, right? I knew that online video was going to be huge. Obviously, I joined Google Video, which was a big mistake. YouTube would have been the better move. But being there in those even still early YouTube days, you know, I think like I came out of Google and moved into YouTube when there were like 35 people. It was just fascinating. The growth was unheard of. I actually always said I had the best job of anybody out at Google. Because it wasn't that we were kind of tone deaf to the fact that there was a lot of copyrighted work on the platform. It wasn't that we were trying to deny that. If anything, we were doing a lot of work in the background to detect those copyrighted works and actually then make a positive story where we work with the Disneys and then the News Corps of the world to help monetize those copyrighted works, right? Because if you think it true, people will go through the pain of ripping some video content off their TV, transcoding it and then uploading it back. I mean, like those are probably your biggest fans. So you kind of don't want to squash them. If anything, you want to embrace them and then maybe help monetize that. So it wasn't that we kind of didn't realize all of
so
that.
So your job was to say to the entertainment companies, to the sports companies, look, why squash this person? The content is now on there. Let's talk about how you can make money from it. That was your job?
Yeah. So, and obviously that came from my Shazam background, right? Because I knew one thing or another about content recognition and how to find writer works, but then also the whole business around it. And so it was just fantastic. The people that I met at honestly the highest levels at all these companies, was just great. I actually always say Google got sued by Viacom for $1 billion. Nobody has ever actually remarked that or asked it themselves the question, why didn't any of the other big media companies join in that lawsuit? Would have been very easy, right? It's like, you know what? I'm Disney. I'm going to join Viacom and we'll make it a $2 billion. None of them did because they knew all too well that we weren't sitting there like lame ducks. We were actively trying to work with them in a very positive manner.
And that was your job to do that.
That's right. Yeah.
So do you have any tips about how to work with, negotiate, partner with somebody who wants to destroy you? Do you have an example of somebody you turned around who thought coming into this, you guys are crushing us?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't have a good example for that. Mm-hmm. There's a good saying, right? If you can find them, join them. But I think it's a good comment, or if it wasn't a comment, maybe more of a question. I think sometimes you have to come to the realization that maybe something or somebody is too much for you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's hard to swallow your pride and actually, then I don't know, go to them and say like, look, you know, how can I work with you in a more positive manner? And what can I change in myself to make it more palatable for you? I don't have a good example, but those are difficult moments, especially in the starting company. And it's hard to recognize or admit to those moments.
They were incredibly angry at you guys back then, especially since, to be honest, there were a bunch of emails from the original YouTube co-founders talking about how they intentionally wanted this, that this is a thing, right? So the fact that you guys turned it around makes sense. Now I understand too why the Shazam guy came in handy, because you had the credibility to say we can create software that would tag your stuff. So let's continue then. Well, actually, I have one other question about that. You went from being a founder, which in San Francisco is one of the coolest things to be, to being an employee of somebody else's vision. What was that like?
Yeah, it was fun, actually. Never forget, I guess Google is like a giant startup, at least back then. I was given a lot of autonomy.
You didn't feel like, I'm an entrepreneur, I just gave this up to get... No, none of that. I'm watching your face.
A little bit in the beginning, it actually feels a little bit like, almost like a relief, right? Because the pressure, the stress gets removed, and everybody needs that time to kind of kick back a little bit. And that's also why, I love Google. I still love Google. But if you ever wonder why did you only stay there for 3.5 years, there's nothing wrong with the company or in my job or my colleagues. I was just itching to be back in the startup side. That's it.
I have a friend who was an entrepreneur who just became an employee. His health is better. He's got a personal trainer. He's messaging me about the different things he's doing, like burpees, how he's enjoying. He's still working really hard, but there's something about not being a founder. It's a reset, though.
Yeah. I mean, the most successful founders are those who can manage their work in a way and their teams in a way where they only have to work 2 hours a day, right? That is the, if you can do that.
I'm going to skip over the part that you were president of TrueCar. You work with Scott Painter, one of the best entrepreneurs who's not super well known, right? But why don't we skip over all that and ask about Tatari? Where did the idea come from for Tatari?
It's actually an observation from TrueCar. Okay. At TrueCar, we eventually got into TV advertising, right, as a way to keep growing the company, but also really got a very quick taste of how the more traditional agencies could truly mess up TV campaigns and truly waste a lot of money, millions of dollars. I became aware that if you can only inject a little bit of kind of Silicon Valley pedigree and technology into the world of TV advertising and make it a little bit more like digital, like you said in the beginning, mm-hmm. and then it can make a day and night difference. And so that was kind of the personal observation and experience.
Yeah, this is TrueCar. So I think for people who don't know, TrueCar is a place where I can go shop, buy a new or used car, right? That was their thing, bringing it online.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we ended up going massively on TV. Not always a great story. And so
I do remember seeing a bunch of TrueCar ads. What did you do? I remember talking to the founder of Carbonite. He said, "Oh yeah, I've been buying Rush Limbaugh ads for years. Here's how it works. You do the whole." He's the guy who told me about the IP and region when it runs and time when it runs. What did you guys do? What kind of backflips before Tatari did you do to figure out if your ads were actually working on TV?
I mean, it all comes back to data and analytics, looking at the right data sets, making sure that your data inputs are correctly.
Yeah, what data were you looking for? Because you guys, I don't think, would do a slash anything. It wasn't like truecar.com/murder-she-wrote so that we...
Yeah, that's right. So the data that's available today versus, you know, as little as 5 years ago is so different, right? So we will look at data that comes out of set-top boxes, even data that comes out of smart TVs. And then that's not necessarily privacy invasion. This is all done on an anonymous basis.
Yep.
But in an aggregate manner, you can get a quick sense to what extent people react at or they didn't, right? And then that way you can you can optimize those campaigns, right? If you see, if you have two different, let's say, commercials, then you can quickly find out, oh, well, commercial number one is actually the better one because 50% of people actually react to that one compared to commercial two. And so looking at all of that data, correctly analyzing it, then you can start optimizing your campaigns. And so these are meaningful optimizations, right? Because even if it's only, let's say, a 10% improvement on a $20 million per year TV budget, that's $2 million right there.
Do you have an example of a bad experience that you had because you couldn't get data that led you to create Tatari, or a good one that led you to create Tatari?
Just funny instances, right?
Mm-hmm. Like what?
At one point, there was a creative which was truly built for female auto buyers, and that was actually accidentally, by mistake, run on probably one of the most male-focused networks, and it outperformed the pop.
It did.
And so why? It's hard to explain, right? Because you and I might look at this creative and say, like, well, that's not for males. But then it turns out that, you know, the kind of wisdom of the crowds shows, right? Or the market actually shows.
And the only reason you were able to do it is because at TrueCar, you guys got good at getting data on what ads worked.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, look, if there's anything I've learned that TrueCar is that, you know, TV advertising can make a big difference to a company if it's done correctly. And that led me to Tatari. Now, the work that we've done at Tatari is infinitely ahead of what was ever done at TrueCar. Today, we will measure campaigns for quite a few companies. The IAB, which is the Internet Advertising Bureau, they listed, published a list of the 250 most disruptive, what they call direct-to-consumer brands. And if you look at that list of those that do TV, almost half of them will work with us. So companies like a Poshmark, a Turo, a Roman, these are all companies that now kind of have handed over their TV campaigns to us because of the kind of the digital approach that we have to it.
And what by the way, your website is so good because of that image, that video that comes on, or whatever the animation is. It almost gives me a headache. But it's fantastic for explaining what you do. I don't even want to reveal it. You know, the white text on black background?
We just relaunched the website like 3-4 days ago. So I'm glad you appreciate it.
The whole site is really well done. Considering what you guys do, you don't need this kind of like creativity. So then what do you guys do to help people, to help advertisers track their impressions and cost per view and so on?
So look, there's certain... ultimately, we're bringing data and analytics to the world of TV advertising. And that kind of takes a role or manifests itself in two pieces. The first one is in the measurement, right? Was one creative better than the other? Was one streaming platform worse better than the other, right? And so we'll do this all day long, and we always tell people where they should allocate their dollars. The other thing we'll do is actually meticulously track television ad inventory. Right? What ads can I buy? Where can I buy them? What's the pricing? Was there a fire sale? If it was sold in an auction model, what were those clearances in the auctions? And if you collect all that data in large amounts, then you can flip it around, run analytics again, and drive what we would call bid optimizations. Right? If a network says that spot will cost you $50,000, we may actually have figured out that a more correct value is something more like $40,000. And we might offer that amount of money instead. And find success, but in that you can see an immediate 20% saving. So we'll do a lot of data and analytics and media buying as well.
I'm very mindful of the time because I know you've got kids that you can pick up from school. We'll close out with that. What does Tatari mean?
Tatari mean actually doesn't mean anything. I had asked a friend at the time, hey, do you have a fun Bengali or maybe just general foreign language work for quick or transparent? And she said, you know, Tatari. I'm like, that's cool. And then I looked it up, and lo and behold, it's pronounceable six-letter .com domain name, still available for sale. I paid something like $6,000 for it. And nobody really liked it. But one, nobody came up with a better name. Two, when I shared a name with somebody, they actually remembered it. Unlike Shazam, 5 days later, people still, today, people still misspell it.
Shazam? There's a way to misspell it?
Oh gosh, I've seen everything. Okay. And so I'm not going to give you the misspellings because I'm not going to inspire you.
No, don't get it in my head.
But Tatari, I didn't see any of that. Later found out that actually the person who gave me the name Tatari, I made a mistake. That wasn't even a correct word.
But yeah, I looked that up. It's not a word. It is a last name. At least one person I found in from Istanbul on Crunchbase has the last name Tatari.
You are excellent in Google search.
I'm searching everything as we talk.
So anyway, it's stuck. I think it's a good name. I'm happy we chose that name. Yeah.
All right, you're going to go pick up your kids. How old are your kids?
They are 8 and 9. How about yours?
5 and 3, just started kindergarten. And one of my things that I'm doing is making sure to get out early and go pick them up before, like, be one of the early parents to pick them up and spend time with them. I don't know if you saw it. There was this LinkedIn blog post going around recently about a father who lost one of his twin sons. And it just really moved me. And he said at the end, just spend as much time as you can with your kids. You never know. And I realized, you know what? They probably are going to go somewhere at some point, right? You ideally want them to go. I should spend as much time with them now as possible. So yesterday I left early and I took my kindergartner to coffee. You know, he didn't have coffee.
That's a wonderful thing to do. Actually, this weekend I was in Pennsylvania for 3 days with my younger daughter for a 3-day father-daughter event.
Oh, I want to do that. Yeah, those little bonding experiences, I think they go a long way.
Yeah, this is something you can never take back. And actually, I think it also makes for, if you spend that time, it makes for a better relationship with your kids.
But I think so. I'll say one other thing, that I was talking to this one cab driver who was dropping me off somewhere, and he said, he's really troubled. I said, what's troubling you? We started talking. He didn't get into details, but there was something going on with his son. So I said, what do you do? He said, you just have to count on the things that you put in early on coming through right now when he's going through his stuff. So putting in stuff early on. All right. For anyone who wants to go check out your site, it's tatari.com, tatari.com. I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you're hiring developers, go check out toptal.com/Mixergy. And the second, if you're looking to create a sales funnel, get leads, close sales, really don't make the mistake I made of turning away this company. It is phenomenal. Check out clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. Thanks, Philip. I'll let you go. Bye.
Andrew, have a good rest of the day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.